would really like to see us create a kinder training system for physicians, because that's where we all start. And if we create a culture that emphasizes kindness and separates achievement and failure from our self-worth and gives us space and time to talk about emotions and fears of failure and perfectionism and create a more holistic assessment system of trainees.
This is Meaningful Medicine. In a challenging and unpredictable world with high burnout rates, this is a podcast where incredible individuals share their most meaningful patient experiences and focus on those moments of positivity and joy that sparked their love of healthcare and changed the way they practice medicine.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hohenstein, and I'm an emergency medicine resident at UCSF.
Hi, I'm Shiva Kayambashi. I'm a doctor and professor of family and community medicine at UCSF.
We're the co-hosts of Meaningful Medicine. We created this podcast to highlight stories of healthcare professionals who have found a sense of meaning, resilience, and joy in their work. Hey, Shiva, how are you doing?
Hi, Nicole. I'm doing pretty well. Thank you. How are you today?
I am doing great. I'm very excited to be talking about imposter syndrome today. Before medical school, I had not heard of the term imposter syndrome. But I vividly remember in my first year of medical school entering my first small group with all of my classmates. And I remember looking around and noticing that a lot of my classmates at UCSF had gone to Ivy League schools, had their master's degrees, were just ridiculously smart. And not only was I intimidated, but I started doubting my own intelligence and I started questioning my place in medical school. Could I do this? Am I smart enough? And I think it's really interesting to think about how we talk about ourselves and talk to ourselves. And I started noticing that the more and more I had self-doubt and had negative self-talk, the more I could feel my confidence taking a hit. And slowly, over my first year, I was able to build back that self-talk, eventually the self-confidence. And the way I did it was really focusing on my strengths. And for me, that was really the patient interactions and the group activities where I was able to work with others. And by focusing on my strengths rather than my weaknesses, I was able to build up that self-confidence and overcome what I now recognize was probably imposter syndrome. And I definitely appreciate having that experience. And it definitely, as I'm continuing on in my career into residency, and I can imagine on as an attending in emergency medicine, I could see imposter syndrome continuing to creep in. But I do feel like having those strategies to overcome imposter syndrome is very important. What do you think about imposter syndrome, Shiva?
First of all, I appreciate your sharing your experience, Nicole. I really resonate with that. And I'm really glad that we're going to spend today's session talking with our panelists about imposter syndrome or imposter phenomenon. And I resonate with you. I think a lot of medical students and probably many people who are beginning in some kind of graduate program or even college, when you start into something new, as for example, I had a very similar experience as you when I was beginning my first year of medical school, the feeling of comparing yourself to others and feeling as though you really don't belong or that you couldn't possibly match up to their level of greatness. I do think that's a very common phenomenon. And the first time I had heard of it, I believe I must have just been starting college and a new book had come out. And the title really struck me. It was called, If I'm So Successful, Why Do I Feel Like a Fake? And when I read that, I just resonated so much because I felt kind of a lot of the time like a fake, like other people thought more of me than I did. And so I do think it has a lot to do with self-doubt, with something about humility kind of crossing over into self-doubt more than anything, and learning techniques, like you said, about how to talk to ourselves and how to help ourselves be lifted up. Because really, there is no other you and there is no other me. And I think us learning to be able to kind of value ourselves as we are, as opposed to comparing ourselves and feeling so out of place, might be part of the healing process out of it. But I have to tell you, that imposter feeling got better in medical school, it came back again in residency. And then once it got better, it came back again when I became an attending. And then once it got better. So I don't think it's something that ever really goes away. But I'm so excited that we get to speak to our guests today to hear some of their wisdom and their experiences.
Today, we are excited to introduce our three panelists who will be discussing imposter syndrome in medicine. I'd like to introduce Dr. Rosny Daniel. He was born and raised in Huntington Beach, California, went to Occidental College in LA, and moved to San Francisco for medical school shortly after. He found his passion for emergency medicine as it combines acute care, critical thinking, a collaborative environment, and ample opportunities to care for the underserved. Dr. Daniel also works in education at UCSF, teaching medical students, residents, and faculty on a broad range of topics in emergency medicine and health equity. Outside of work, Dr. Daniel enjoys hanging out with friends, exercising, playing sports, watching sports and rom-coms, cooking, listening to music and podcasts, trying fancy cocktails, and petting dogs. Welcome, Dr. Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
We're excited to have you, Dr. Daniel. And Dr. Marianne Juarez is an associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at UCSF. She grew up outside of Detroit, Michigan, completed her medical school training at the University of Michigan and residency at UCSF at SF General Hospital. In addition to working clinically in the emergency department, she's heavily involved in medical student education, mentorship, and teaching at all levels with a focus on DEI and gender equity. The emergency department often feels like a quiet reprieve from her other job, which is chasing twin toddlers around her home with her partner, but she wouldn't have it any other way. She also enjoys traveling, spending time with loved ones, sports, puzzles, exercise, and reorganizing her house as a way to avoid doing work that she should be doing. Welcome, Dr. Juarez.
Thanks so much for having me.
And our last panelist for today is Dr. Jill Mangialuzzo. She is an emergency medicine physician at ZSFG, where she is committed to the compassionate care of populations disadvantaged by the system and the humanistic education of future physicians. She serves as assistant residency director for the UCSF ZSFG EM residency program, as well as UCSF's EM medical education fellowship director. Her primary interest in medical education is GME policy and advocating for structural changes to residency education, as well as biases within feedback and assessment of trainees. Welcome, Dr. Mangialuzzo.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, panelists. We're so excited to have you.
We are very excited to have you, and we're very excited to have this conversation with you about imposter syndrome today, which is such an important theme for so many people on the planet, and particularly professionals in healthcare. We like to start each of our episodes by asking our guests to, in short, share a meaningful moment from sometime early in your training that might have been a particularly formative or defining experience. Dr. Mangialuzzo, would you mind going first?
Sure. I have an experience just recently happened that was very formative in my ongoing learning and career in medicine. Being a physician is part of my identity and influences how I relate to everything in the world around me. And this past summer, my dad was unexpectedly diagnosed with neuroendocrine pancreatic cancer. He is doing incredibly well right now and had a great surgical outcome, but it was a challenging few months. And I had the ability to be there with him through surgery and after when he had complications in his immediate post-op recovery. My dad did not go to college and does not have high health literacy, and what I found was how much he started to rely on me to translate what the healthcare team was telling him. During their daily rounds, I spent a lot of time thinking about how they communicated uncertainty and how I chose to frame his options to him, with trying to preserve his own autonomy and not inserting myself too much. His healthcare team was wonderful. But I think it's so easy for us in medicine to get caught up in jargon and forget to explain the bigger picture and keep re-explaining in all the ways that our patients can understand regardless of their educational background. So it was meaningful for me to be able to do that for him as his daughter, as an advocate. And it also was a good reminder of what being on that end of healthcare is like and receiving healthcare communication. And so I really incorporated that with how I talk to my patients and ensuring that I'm still focusing on their big picture for them.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mangiuluzzo. That's a very powerful story and deeply meaningful. Thank you. Dr. Juarez, would you share a meaningful moment?
Yeah, so when I was thinking about this question in advance, I had a hard time not thinking of something that had to do with imposter syndrome. I think maybe that's kind of part of what's in my mind, but also just thinking back about my path to medicine, kind of throughout medicine, that this is something that continues to kind of play out. And one situation I could remember was to get into medical school at first, I thought was, you know, I knew it was going to be challenging. I wasn't sure that this was somewhere that I belonged in the first place. I was always someone who I had to work really hard. I studied really hard. Things didn't just come to me. I was the person who was studying all the way up to an exam. I was never someone who, I am still not someone who likes to raise my hand or be the first to answer a question. I'm usually kind of sit in the background and hope that someone does not call on me. And if they do, I really hope that I say the right thing and that I don't mess up. And I guess during medical school for us, there was always this chance that when you're on your clinical rotations, you could get pimped or someone would call on you and they'd be asking you question after question. You were expected to know the answer. I think now as a medical educator, I look back on that and realize maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe they were just trying to assess our you know, level of knowledge and continue to encourage us to answer questions appropriately. But in that moment, it felt really stressful. And there was a case when I was on my pediatrics rotation. There was a young girl, I think she might have been 5. I think she was in sort of the step-down unit. She was pretty sick with some respiratory distress. Newly diagnosed what we thought was maybe like a reactive airway disease, and she had a lot of wheezing, but she had the highest energy. She was literally like bouncing off the walls, and she was really, heart rate was really high, and her mom's like, yeah, she just gets these things where she's like kind of crazy, and she's really amped up, and she sort of had eyes that sort of stuck out, and I thought, maybe we should test her thyroid. And my attending was like, that's a great idea. And we tested, and sure enough, she was super hyperthyroid. And that was probably the answer to all of her things. And when I think about it, it was such a simple thing. But the response I got from the attending and that amount of approval and just acknowledging that I had said something correctly and that I made a difference in the care of this patient. And he continued to bring it up kind of as the rotation went along. And he ended up being one of my letter writers when I decided to go into emergency medicine and told me that he was sad I wasn't doing pediatrics, which was just such a boost for my confidence and such a big deal for me. And just thinking back on those little words or those little things that folks can do to really kind of boost you up and bring you up and let you recognize that maybe I am okay at this and maybe I did a good thing. And just understanding when I'm in that role now as an educator, what a difference I can make with just little reassurances, little acknowledgments, and how much that actually stuck with me kind of throughout the rest of my career. And there are a couple similar instances, but that was a really meaningful. His name was Dr. Pittich, and he was wonderful. And I just appreciated even just those little words from him.
Thank you so much, Dr. Juarez, for sharing that formative experience. Dr. Daniel, do you mind going next?
Yeah, and it's great to hear these stories from everybody. I think of the first day of residency for me, I was already pretty nervous coming in. And on one of my first patients, I got a needle stick. And that's something I thought just didn't happen to people, and that it was something that only happened to people who made mistakes and weren't doing things correctly. And I felt really devastated. I felt like I'd totally messed things up and that I was never going to be cut to be a resident and that I was going to get kicked out of the program. And I happened to be with the program director on that shift. And fortunately, they were really, really supportive and basically took me aside and said, this just happens. It's unfortunate it happened on your first shift, but it doesn't mean you don't deserve to be here. If I had a bunch of residents that were just like you, I think this would be a fantastic program. And I'm just proud to have you here. So just getting that similar boost of support and confidence was so helpful. Made me feel really reassured and made me realize that there are going to be mistakes that are made throughout my training process and throughout my medical career and that they're unavoidable. And kind of having one on that first night was really upsetting and really scary, but having that really supportive system of someone who I really looked up to and cared about to support me through it and tell me that I was worth it and that I deserved to be there was incredibly helpful. So that was a really important experience just starting off in medicine on literally my first night. And after I kind of talked about that out loud, I realized that basically everyone has had a needle stick or some kind of mistake at some point in their career. So every nurse on that shift and all the other doctors kind of told me about things that had happened to them. And it made me feel less like an outsider and more like someone who was just experiencing the experiences of being a physician and being a trainee.
I love that. The normalizing of mistakes is so important in medicine. And today we're talking about imposter syndrome, which I definitely have experienced multiple times in multiple different arenas. And I think starting off with really how we define imposter syndrome. Dr. Daniel, you did an amazing lecture on imposter syndrome for our residency. I'd love if you could share how you describe imposter syndrome and really describe who's at risk for experiencing it.
Sure, I'm happy to describe imposter syndrome, or as some people call it, imposter phenomenon. It's something that I think people know when they see it or experience it, but it can be hard to describe in words. So I'll take a definition that I put together from a few different definitions and say, imposter syndrome or phenomenon is a psychological term that refers to a pattern of behavior wherein people doubt their abilities and have a persistent fear of being exposed as a fraud. People with imposter syndrome or phenomenon struggle with accurately attributing their performance to their actual competence. So I think in really simple terms, imposter syndrome is when people just feel like they don't belong in a place, where they are acting like they should be there when they really don't feel internally that they should be there. I've started just using imposter phenomenon instead of syndrome, because imposter syndrome kind of refers to something that is a state of being or something that's wrong or a problem, whereas phenomenon just really refers to something that happens in a moment. So I like to think of it as imposter phenomenon, so I feel it less often and don't feel like it's something inherently wrong with me. And there's plenty of risk factors for what can cause imposter syndrome or phenomenon. And just a couple of them that are really common that I'll list are a minoritized race, a female gender identity, someone who's a perfectionist, people with low self-esteem, being in a really intense or competitive environment, and then having poor structural or institutional support. And I think as people hear this, they may be saying, wow, that's the description of what it's like to be in residency or medical school. So I kind of think like all of those things, plus being from a minoritized or traditionally excluded background from your identity, certainly puts people at risk to experience imposter phenomenon.
Thank you so much, Dr. Daniel, for getting us started with defining it and what imposter syndrome might be. I actually love that you distinguish the idea of a syndrome versus phenomenon, because I've heard it referred to as both. And as you were speaking, I started to think, I wonder if we should just call it the imposter experience. I just realized that for myself, because I have the experience of feeling like an imposter in various situations, but it's not like I feel it all the time. So it's not like a syndrome where I suffer from it, you know, perpetually every day of my life. And I wonder if maybe that is something we should consider renaming it, if you will. I wonder if we could also go around our panel and ask if you could remember when you first experienced feeling like an imposter. And maybe, Dr. Juarez, could we start with you?
Thinking back, something that was actually quite vivid, I still remember it very well, was an experience that I had in high school. I've had many experiences in medical school, residency, as faculty. But this moment was sort of a surprise and kind of one of the first times that I was like, maybe they're right and this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing, or there's something wrong with me. I was in high school and I was a great student. I did really well in school. When it came time to apply to colleges, I got into my top choices for schools. And being from Michigan, my mom went to the University of Michigan. I'd been going to football games since I was a kid. This was kind of where I knew my heart belonged, and I was hoping to end up there. And we were sitting in a class, and I was sitting next to one of my best friends, and he had also applied to Michigan and did not get in. And so I was hoping that maybe this sort of played a role in it. And we were going around a circle and saying where we were going to be going to college the next year. And he, in front of everyone, said, the only reason that I got into the University of Michigan is because I was Mexican. And this was one of my best friends, so it was a little bit shocking, a little disappointing, and I think it was coming from a place of him feeling hurt and disappointed. But there was also a lot in the press at that time about affirmative action and admissions into the University of Michigan, and University of Michigan has been cited in a few Supreme Court cases relating to affirmative action, and it was so silly. And when I'm like, I absolutely deserve to go to Michigan. I was top of my class. I went to school with 6,000 kids. I did great in school and I should be going to the school. But I was so nervous that maybe that was the only reason I got in. And he said it in front of everyone. And it was just this really kind of eye-opening time. And it stuck with me. And as I went through school, you know, you still wonder when things are hard or you're feeling challenged, did I make the right decision? Was I really supposed to be here? So that was probably one of the first times someone else kind of said something that really stuck with me. And so it wasn't just me on the inside anymore. Now this was something that maybe was more visible to other folks.
Dr. Daniel, would you be able to also share one of your first experiences with imposter phenomenon?
Yeah, absolutely. As I was listening to Marianne talk about her experiences, I was thinking about experiences that I've had since being a child even. And I remember in middle school having experiences, in high school having experiences, in college kind of all the way up through. And I remember when I got to high school, I went to a high school that not many kids from my middle school went to. And one of the first days in biology class, I was answering a question aloud and I answered it close to correct, but not quite correct. And the teacher then asked me, what school did you go to? And are you sure you're supposed to be in this class? And I'm a person of color. My dad's from Haiti. My mom's white. So my skin is pretty brown, depending on how tan I am during that time of the year. And I think I felt really singled out in that moment, just thinking, wow, this person just thinks I don't belong here. And I remember even as a kid I was 12 years old at the time, remember thinking like, I think I'm being singled out and it makes me feel like maybe I'm not supposed to be here. So in that moment, I think I had a lot of friends and support around, and I've always been lucky to have a very supportive like family who's told me that I deserve things. So I was able to respond to that well and do well in the class. But I think, you know, I could definitely have seen that going the opposite direction and that totally derailing me or making a big problem for my experience in that class. And that was like the first week of high school. So I think of how that could have just totally derailed things for me for that entire kind of academic course through high school if I felt like, oh my gosh, I don't belong here.
Thank you, Dr. Daniel, for sharing that. Your story and Dr. Juarez's story have some similarities that I'm noticing in that both of you had someone else introduced the idea to you that you don't belong, and that might have fed the internal voice you already had, or it might have even created a voice that might not have already been there, but it did come from external, from others, which I think is demonstrative of how we need to be careful of what we say to one another, because it really does impact us and can be impactful for the rest of our lives. Dr. Manjuluzo, would you also share an early experience of imposter phenomena?
Yeah, I remember it kind of creeping in starting in college, really the first few weeks of college. And I was entered this program where it was a group of students, and I don't even remember the purpose of it, but we all lived on the same floor in our dorms. And everyone was like talking about what classes they were taking and all of their AP credit. And I just remember feeling like I had no AP credit going into college. The high school I went with did not have AP courses. And I started to feel like I'm already behind and from my peers. And this was a new city for me. I was the first person in my family to ever go out of state for like even out of county for college. And I felt like so behind already that I just started to get this thought of like, well, I just have to like work extra hard and go above and like beyond. And I think for me, that started a lot of like kind of perfectionism in college and a lot of habits that started there and continued on.
Thank you so much for sharing. Jill, as a follow-up to that, do you feel like when you started to become kind of that more perfectionist personality, do you feel like the imposter syndrome or experience crept up more often because of that?
I do. In college, I think I had an easier time of balancing perfectionism and what standards I set for myself. So I had two jobs. I served on AmeriCorps. I took engineering science classes just to kind of feel like I could do it. And so I set up all these expectations of myself. Where I really started to struggle was when I could no longer maintain those like standards that I thought I needed to reach to be a part of the world around me.
I think what's interesting about all three of our panelists today is their first experience of imposter syndrome happened prior to medicine, prior to medical school, prior to residency, prior to working as a doctor. And it's very interesting to know that imposter syndrome really creeps in prior to the medical experience. Now going into kind of thinking about imposter syndrome in medicine, research has demonstrated that approximately 25% of male medical students and 50% of female medical students have experienced imposter syndrome. Another study found that approximately 30% of family medicine residents and 44% of internal medicine residents also have experienced imposter syndrome during residency. Research published in a study in 2015 in the Journal of Academic Medicine interviewed physicians at different stages of their careers regarding their experience with underperformance. They found that self-doubt and imposter syndrome variably affects physicians at all stages in their careers. Factors that contributed to self-doubt and imposter syndrome included frequent work transitions, highly demanding family and professional environments, psychological traits such as perfectionism or insecurity, as well as social inequities. High-quality patient care often relies on physicians' high standards and attention to detail. When errors occur, physicians may be plagued with guilt, anxiety, self-doubt, and these recurrent feelings of inadequacy can contribute to burnout. All of our wonderful guests are attendings with established careers at UCSF. At this stage, do any of you guys still have moments where you experience imposter syndrome? And what in particular do you think contributes to imposter syndrome or the imposter experience at this stage in your careers as attendings?
I can start with that one, if that's okay with folks. It's always interesting to even hear the description of people telling me that you're an established physician who has a career. And I always take a moment to think, like, is that true? Okay, wait, yes, it is. And something I've really tried to work on to shore that up for myself is having just a bio of myself that when people ask for one, I send it, and I keep trying to add things to it and realize when I look at it, like, okay, I have actually accomplished a lot of things and I do work hard and I do deserve to be here. So that's one thing internally I do to make sure I feel that way. And I do still continue to feel imposter experiences and phenomenon and syndrome all the time. And as you so astutely pointed out, I think that one thing is that it's really hard to have the fully right answer in medicine. And when a lot of us are trying to be perfect and trying to take care of people and things feel like life or death moments, and they are life or death moments in different situations, it can just feel so challenging to feel like I went into work and did something and it was totally right and there was no questions about it. There's always something that could be changed, something that could be done differently. And for me, I think just trying to learn that that is a reality of the job has been really difficult. And I think in medical school, we're taught that there is a right and there is a wrong. And as I've learned to think more critically and done more medical education and thought a lot more about this, it gives me a little bit of comfort to know that there really is often not a right answer for most of the things that we do. There's multiple right answers and there's multiple different ways to approach things. So when I'm really feeling that kind of imposter experience of thinking, wow, I did something really wrong, I remind myself, well, I don't know if there's a right. And it's okay to have that feeling. And it's important for me to just talk about it out loud. So one of the reasons I'm happy to be here today and to know people who've been my mentors, like Dr. Mongeluzzo and Dr. Juarez, who have kind of been there to teach me and help me out throughout this process too.
Yes, I still frequently experience imposter syndrome. I think as a female physician who is underrepresented in medicine, I'll say kind of in the clinical realm, I think I still experience imposter syndrome probably quite often. I feel quite comfortable at this point in my career working with medical students, you know, educating. I think when it comes to residents, they're so smart. Our residents are crazy smart. They're going to challenge us with these wonderful questions. And I sometimes feel like I am not smart enough to be teaching residents. And I will remind myself, I don't have to be smarter than these residents. There's a good chance I am not smarter than a lot of the people that I work with, and that is okay. But I'm here to offer my experiences. I know that I do have more experience. I know that I have things that I can share. I know I've made mistakes. I'm comfortable sharing those experiences and those mistakes and what I've learned from them with other folks to help them learn and to help them grow. And I feel like a lot more of the role that I've kind of grown into is more one of mentorship. And that's something that I really pride myself in. I want to be there. I want to be supportive. I want to help them use their like insane brains to make good decisions and smart decisions and feel safe and secure when they move out into the world or whatever their next steps will be. So just kind of taking myself back to that kind of security and knowing that I do have something to offer and I'm here for a reason. In everything else that I do as far as kind of administratively, I wear a lot of hats. I have a lot of administrative roles and I'm involved in a lot of committees. And UCSF is one of the places that, you know, prides themselves on diversity and having diverse faculty involved in a lot of the committees and things like that. And they're actually required to have 50% of the committees should be either female and or URM. And I kind of check off a lot of those for folks who are working to form these committees. And so sometimes I feel like I'm asked to join a lot of committees because I'm a woman and I'm Latinx. And whether that's the case or not, I think I've decided that I am going to make the best of that. I'm still here. They keep asking me to do things, so I must be doing something right. And maybe it's not all that. And I'm also guilty of asking people to join my committees or my groups because I want to diversify those groups. And I think that there's power in that. And I think that that's something that's really important to be doing. And so I shouldn't necessarily question, even if that is their motivation, which I don't think that's the sole purpose that I'm on all of these committees or asked to be involved in things or the reasons that I get promoted. I sometimes joke I'm still in the fake it till you make it. And maybe that will always feel like that's the case. And I don't know when I will know if I've made it, but I will continue to say yes to things that I feel are going to be beneficial to my career, where I feel I have something to offer and realize that I do have something to offer.
What I love is the normalizing of this imposter experience. I mean, MJ, you are talking about all these incredible accomplishments and, you know, going through all of the amazing, diverse, you know, groups that you're on, groups that you're leading. And yet somehow in the back, there's this still kind of this sense of, well, I think I'm doing enough, but maybe not. And I think it really is something that is carried throughout our experience. And it doesn't necessarily always go away, but normalizing it and saying, you know, it's okay to second guess. And what I loved is when I asked you to be part of this imposter syndrome panel, you joked, you're like, I'm having imposter syndrome about being on the imposter syndrome panel. And I love that. I think that the more that I see my mentors owning up and saying, you know, I'm not always confident, I'm not always assured with myself, I, you know, sometimes have that self-doubt, and that's okay, and I overcome that, I think that just shows that it's okay, and it's part of the experience. So I appreciate you.
And Marianne, just to briefly add on to that, I totally agree with so many things you say. And I think having people around who I mentor or who are just ahead of me in terms of mentorship is really important space to be, because I can highlight things that they're doing well and remind them, hey, you're doing a great job at this, and help them, give them confidence. I think it's a totally a feedback loop where they're appreciative and tell you, wow, thanks for doing this for me, I look up to you. And then having people just ahead of me too. So I've really found that continuing to support people and be a mentor makes me feel better about myself. And it's easier to say things about others than it is about myself sometimes. And similarly, just having some mentors who really believe in me and sponsor me and kind of hype me up when I need it is really helpful too.
Thank you. I appreciate you too. And thanks for saying that.
Dr. Montreluzzo, would you also be able to share?
Yeah, I feel this almost every day still. And what I've come to focus on is not the feeling of it, but what my behaviors around it. And what I mean by that is kind of questioning with myself, like, am I being a perfectionist? Am I experiencing anxiety about something? Am I doing even something like self-sabotaging behaviors around the anxiety of imposter syndrome or phenomena? And what I've really come full circle with is like two things. One, a lot of these experiences of imposter syndrome are deeply like rooted in my childhood. And I've come to really have a lot of gratitude in my experiences growing up in a low socioeconomic area of Appalachia and in an Italian immigrant family, and really having that ground me in how I relate to learners and patients and the world around me. And so I've tried to focus on gratitude for that. And then also what I have found really helpful is just really embracing my own vulnerability and really trying to model that for others. And, you know, being like, I don't know this and no one in medicine knows this, or I don't know this, I should know this and I need to look it up, or I made a mistake and next time this is how I'll do this differently. And really like focusing on those things has helped me kind of get through what's taken a long time post-residency to kind of work through. And I also will say I have had amazing therapists that have also helped me through some of these feelings.
I just wanted to add too, I think that we often think of the imposter experience as a really negative thing, and it certainly can be if it's repetitive and it's overwhelming and we feel all those negative feelings of it and it leads to burnout and leads to stress. It certainly can be bad. I think it also, in a way, is something that I think that it is normal and okay to feel like I'm not perfect, because I don't want to be a perfectionist and I don't want to think like, oh, everything I do is great and I am like a fantastic person with no flaws at all. I think it's important to continue to have some humility. So it's hard to kind of balance that experience of imposter experience with humility a little bit. And I know they're very, very different things, but I do just want to say I'm okay sometimes with having that imposter experience or just being reminded of myself like, okay, like, yeah, I'm really good at this thing. Maybe I could do this better. And it's maybe not that I don't belong here or that I can't attribute any of these positive things to myself. But yeah, like I need to have some humility also and realize that there are, you know, so many people who I want to bring along on this journey with me and so many people involved like in this community and so many people that have made it possible for me to even be in this space, that I acknowledge that, yes, I do a lot of things that are really positive and really great, but I also am just so thankful to be here and thankful for all the people that helped me and thankful to be a part of a community that allows me to be in the space that I'm in. So I don't know if I'm exactly parsing those things out correctly, but that's just something I always think about when I think of imposter experiences always being framed as a negative thing. And sometimes it can be something that I use it as a little bit of inspiration to keep me grounded and inspiration to keep doing better, I think.
I am so glad that you mentioned this, Dr. Daniel. When Shiva and I were talking about my personal experience with imposter syndrome, I was mentioning how in residency, I've definitely been experiencing imposter syndrome. And I qualified that with, well, I think if you go into residency as a new time doctor and you're not feeling some sort of way about, you know, feeling insecure, feeling quote unquote imposter syndrome, then I think you're doing something wrong. Because if you're not in this learning mindset, if you're not thinking about that you are in a place where there's always going to be improvement, you don't know everything, there's always something new to learn, new ways to grow, then honestly, I think that you're just stunting your ability to become a better physician. And so I do think that at this stage of my career, and honestly, at most stages of your career, having some sort of imposter syndrome can be self-motivating, just like you said, and can be humbling and can allow you to really allow yourself to have that growth mindset. So thank you so much for bringing that up.
I'm glad we're talking about that because it brings up some thoughts about a lot of us who suffer from being on this end of the spectrum where we don't think very highly of ourselves or we think we don't belong or feel that imposter feeling. Sometimes people give us compliments. Sometimes people try to bring us in. And because we're accustomed to not feeling like we belong or that we have any worth, we tend to deflect. And I remember I did that a lot. I would deflect any compliment if someone would bring to my attention. I would say, no, I'm not, you know, whatever it is they said that I was. And that never felt good. But the thing that I learned was that a step in the right direction is to stop deflecting, to stop rejecting compliments, and to simply say thank you. So when someone gives me a compliment in the future, I started to practice that where someone would say something kind or positive about me, and instead of saying, no, that's not true, you're wrong, and laugh about it, I would say, thank you. That is really nice of you to say that. And then gradually, as I did that more and more, I started to not only not deflect or reject compliments, and not only be neutral about it or thank the giver of compliment, but to also embrace a little bit that maybe it's true. Maybe there is something positive about me. And I think that was part of my healing in the direction out of feeling like an imposter so much of the time. Does that resonate with anyone on our panel, or would anyone like to share around that?
Those of you who know me know I always have a comment about everything, but I certainly agree with what you were saying. I think a couple things come up for me with that. One thing I think about that's part of the definition of imposter syndrome or phenomenon is thinking about this external and internal sources of validation. So oftentimes people who have imposter phenomenon that is pathologic can't have, they don't really believe that there's any kind of internal source of the things that they do well. They often attribute things that they do well to external sources and don't take any credit for it. So I definitely think that's something that I've thought about a lot and worked on a lot, is just saying thank you when someone tells me something positive about myself, or just being appreciative for a moment and saying thank you and just sitting with that. It can feel uncomfortable and it can feel awkward, but I think as people continue to stretch and strengthen that muscle and that ability, I think it's easier to say thank you for things. And it's not being arrogant to just say, yeah, I did do that well. Like, thank you. I appreciate that. I certainly think that our intersectional selves, there's so many different parts of our identities that allow us to do that or allow us to be judged by ourselves or others. So, you know, we talked in the beginning about a minoritized race or female gender identity as things that can be risk factors for imposter syndrome and imposter phenomenon. And I certainly think that our culture often tells us that, you know, there's certain people who are good and certain people who are more valuable. And we need to continue to really think critically about what those traditionally have been and continue to flip the script and be thoughtful and critical about how we think about those things. So recognizing when I have spaces where my identity is coming into play to either make me feel uncomfortable or make me feel minoritized or make me feel excluded, or it's in a place where I realize, oh, this is partly my male identity, for instance, that is giving me a privilege in this space, and just thinking about how that's interacting with my emotions and feelings and experiences as well.
I find myself, I remember the negative feedback, I remember the criticism, but I oftentimes forget the compliments. And so I think it's just as important to make a mental note of anytime someone gives you a compliment, believe the compliment, because you sure as heck are believing the criticism. So I definitely think that's important. And following up, talking about the role of identity, we know that our social identities certainly play a role in imposter syndrome. Would any of you feel comfortable telling us how you think about the role of intersectionality in imposter syndrome?
When I think about the intersectionality and all of the different roles and identities that I carry, I identify as a female, I'm Latinx, I am a physician, I'm a mother, I'm an educator. I think these are a lot of big ways that I show my identity. And how do those all come together? I almost feel like I could sense imposter syndrome in any one of those roles at a certain time. And sometimes if I'm giving in to one of those, I might be taking away from another. So I just need to understand that there will always be a give and take between those identities. And at some times I need to kind of respect one more than another. And that's okay. There's just no true way to separate them. And I just have to understand that I will do my best in all of these identities. I will do my best to represent them in the best way that I can. I hope that when I show up as Dr. Juarez, my patients see that name and they feel some connection. And it's always something I'm a little anxious about, because I'm not sure if I would call myself, I guess I've been asked in the past if I was like a real Mexican. I didn't grow up in a primarily Spanish-speaking household. I'm half Mexican. My dad didn't grow up speaking Spanish. He grew up in Detroit. If you spoke Spanish in school, you would get in trouble. His parents made a decision not to teach them Spanish. We did a lot of the little cultural things, but I never really understood until much later that that was something my grandparents were trying to instill in me, some pieces of their, you know, Mexican culture, without being like too overt, so as to make us feel out of place in the place where we grew up. And so I get a little anxious when I present myself in that way and people kind of look at you and expect you to speak Spanish. And is that enough? Am I okay in that role? They see me again as like a female physician. I frequently get called nurse. I know this is very common. Am I enough in that role? Am I doing enough to represent women? Am I doing enough to represent mothers and, you know, working mothers? Am I doing all these things correctly? And I think just giving myself a little bit of a break and recognizing that I can only do so much in each of these, and I will bring the best that I can. And it's hard to represent all of your identities at the same time. So just letting folks know that, like, we all have a lot of different identities. It's okay to feel like you're not always the best representative of each of them all the time, but just kind of doing our best to do what we can.
Thank you so much for sharing. We would love to understand, thinking about in our lives, at work, in our homes, are there any institutional or cultural changes that could be implemented to decrease the rates of imposter syndrome or imposter phenomena?
I would really like to see us create a kinder training system for physicians, because that's where we all start. And if we create a culture that emphasizes kindness and separates achievement and failure from our self-worth and gives us space and time to talk about emotions and fears of failure and perfectionism and create a more holistic assessment system of trainees, I'd like to see us start there, which is a big ask. I also see this very much tied in with topics of burnout and wellness and issues around diversity, equity, and inclusion. They're all connected.
I agree. And Dr. Mangeluzzo and I have talked offline about this a few times, about the idea that we need to totally rethink how, at least in medicine, how we train people. A lot of things can often feel like punitive or judgmental. And I kind of struggle with that process. So for instance, in the M&M process or QI process, the way that we traditionally do that, it's often focusing on a mistake that happened or a problem or something. And to me, I think, yes, it can be helpful for our learning to think about mistakes, but separating the mistakes from the person and talking about objective changes that can be made, structural changes that can be made to be helpful, and then also having things that are like shout outs and encouragements and making sure that we're being thoughtful that everyone's getting them and it's not just the same people getting them all the time. My partner is in internal medicine, and it's not just internal medicine, it's all kinds of departments, but we talk about how often the same people get highlighted and awarded over and over, which I'm sure those people are doing great work and it's important to be thankful for them, but it's also important to thank everybody who's doing the work and really create a culture of people being appreciative and in community with each other. So not just in competition, but in community.
Thank you both for sharing. I think I don't have too much more to add. I would continue along the lines of just normalizing people's feelings, thoughts, behaviors, recognizing, giving recognition where it's due, making sure that we, as Dr. Daniel said, just recognizing folks appropriately, being very aware of who we're talking about when we're talking about them and highlighting a lot of the statistics, at least, that point to the folks who are feeling more of the imposter syndrome, or at least that is, you know, documented, are folks who tend to potentially be a little bit more quiet, a little more softer spoken, and don't always feel like they are supposed to have the seat at the table, and so may not get recognized as much, and just being very aware of that, making sure that we're creating equal opportunities and making people know that they do belong, like you're here for a reason, and saying why they belong and letting them know. So not just being like, oh, no, you belong, but here are all the reasons that you're here. And this is, look at all these amazing things that you've done. And this is what I feel like you can contribute. And we've mentioned before a lot about mentorship and lifting people up and how amazing that feels when you're the person, you know, doing the mentoring, but it is a two-way street. And I think we can do better.
Yeah. And just to add that, as you're saying it, formal education for people who are educators to talk to them about how do you create a supportive learning environment, and just telling people to literally say aloud, hey, you belong here. I'm glad to have you here. How can I support you? It goes such a long way. And it's something that we're not often taught to think about.
I love that. I felt with all three of your responses, really creating an environment that is like a family, that is supportive, that is open, that's communicative, that is one where we care about not only who you are at work, but who you are outside of work, and creating that community, and hopefully is a theme that the institutions will take into consideration and will continue to build in each and every program. As we wrap up the podcast today, we were hoping that you all could share some advice for medical trainees who may be struggling with imposter syndrome or self-doubt.
I think there's a lot of power in advocating for system change and speaking up for where you feel like the system is failing you and your peers. And I know that advocating for change for trainees has really been a main driver so that people don't have to go through what some of us have gone through. My second thing is also just consider if you're feeling this a lot, to kind of seek help for it, because residency is so busy. It's so hard to take time for yourself, and these feelings can just start building and building and building until they lead to things like anxiety and depression. And it's not a failure to go and take time for yourself, and that I hope that you're in residency programs and training programs that can support that, and they should support that.
I think my advice would be to know that you are enough and you are here for a reason. Whatever you are doing, to recognize that it's happening, take advantage of that. And even if you feel, like I mentioned before, that maybe you were invited for some other reason, or you thought maybe you got in for some other reason, recognize again, someone felt like you belonged here. Someone had faith or believed in you at some point along the way and said that you could do this. And they did it for a reason. So you should continue to follow that. Try to say yes. Even if you think it's a reach, there's a good chance. Again, you're being asked to do something for a reason, and folks believe in you. So as best you can, try and believe in yourself too, and know that there are always people around you to support you.
Yeah, and I agree to echo Dr. Juarez and Dr. Mangialuzzo. I think, and something that Dr. Hohenstein said earlier too, it's very normal to feel like an imposter at times and to have that experience. So that is very normal. The problem is if it's something that is creeping in and happening all the time and leading to things like depression, anxiety, burnout, et cetera. So when those things happen, just being able to talk about them out loud, I think that people often feel like they're going to be kicked out or going to get in trouble if they say these things. But it's our job as educators and as people in community with you all to help combat those things when they come up. So just talking about them out loud, making sure you're finding your community. And it may not just be within medicine and, you know, in your medical school class or residency class. It can be people outside of that. It can be your therapist. It can be your partner. It can be your friends. I'm very fortunate to have a group of friends that all graduated right around the same time as me. And one of the things we do is just talk about our experiences. And some days we'll send a text out to the group that just says, here's something challenging that happened today. And we all just might talk about it and acknowledge it. And some people say it might say, hey, here's something that really positive that happened, and we all talk about it and acknowledge it. But oftentimes there are other people feeling the same way as you. It's okay to feel that way and just talk about it out loud. There is plenty of space for that. It's part of the process, is not just developing your kind of medical knowledge and medical skills, but developing your skills as a person, your communication, your self-confidence, and your ability to continue to just be a person, because you can't really be a good doctor if you're not feeling okay as a person first.
Thank you all so much for being on the podcast today, sharing your personal experiences, your wisdom with all of us. We are so incredibly appreciative. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mangialuzzo, Dr. Juarez, and Dr. Daniel. This has been a pleasure to talk with you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for tuning in today
and allowing us to be one of your meaningful moments.
Please rate, review, and subscribe, and share with friends, family, and colleagues. Meaningful Medicine was produced by Shiva Kayambashi, Nicole Hohenstein, David Elkin, Nikki Elkin, Ahaley Chattopadhyay, and Leigh Kodama. Editing by Nicole Hohenstein, Nikki Elkin, and Leigh Kodama. Intro and closing by Daniel Wendling. On Meaningful Medicine, we are careful to ensure that all stories are compliant with healthcare privacy laws, and details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are of the person speaking and not their employer.